Joel was saying how you got money to experiment and then you asked him to leave WTTW to like for the 90s. I'm interviewing you guys about the 90s today.
Probably so. The first money I think came from MacArthur Foundation, which we've been hustling for a long time.
I guess that like connects to my first question. So like I read that like the PBS said they didn't want to fund it anymore. So, like, was that the whole reason why the show ended, or was there something else that, like, affected it?
I think that was the main reason it ended. That PBS, we got in a little bit of hot water with the election specials that we produced. And I'll take full responsibility for that.
What do you mean by that?
So basically, we were commissioned to do three election specials in 1992, and one of them was about the conventions, the Republican convention and the Democratic convention, and the Democrats gave us a lot of access to the behind the scenes of what was going on, and the Republicans basically gave us press passes to the convention, but not much else. I went down to the Republican convention with Bob Hercules and a guy named Stoney Burke. I don't know if you've seen that show or not.
Yeah, I read about the controversy.
Yeah. So Stoney was, I would say, a bit confrontational with some of the, people, but really PBS was mostly upset about that Stoney was representing himself as PBS and not as from the 90s, you know, an independent show that happens to be on PBS. And Tom and I sat in a meeting at the head of productions at WTTW with PBS in DC intermittently on the phone, and back and forth on what could stay in the show and what had to get out of the show and what could stay in the show. And this was, as I recall, very close to air time, like within a couple days of it going on the air. So we were in a meeting for, I don't know, 8 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
Going back and forth, and then had to go into the edit room and take out the things that we finally agreed to take out. So for that show, there are two versions that exist for that show. One is the PBS edited version and one is the original version that we created. And it was at a time when PBS was under a lot of fire. CPB especially was under a lot of fire from the Republicans about funding. And it was the beginning of the Family Values Crusade. And we were kind of a fringe enterprise. And so, and it was easy for them to just say goodbye to us and not fund us anymore. It wasn't worth the hassle, I think, for them. I don't know if you have a different view, Tom, but
I think that's essentially what happened. I won't let you take the full blame because I suspect if I had gone to Houston with everybody, which I almost always was part of the production, but I wasn't that one for reasons that I couldn't stand the Republicans and I was afraid I'd act up. I'd be worse than I should have been. And I didn't look forward to it. And so it was the first time I personally didn't get directly involved in producing. So I take some of that blame. But regardless, I think what happened is that CPB funds PBS, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is funded directly by the Congress. And so there were certain, there were some people in the Congress who were let us say, didn't show up very well in the show, and Stoney was really rude to them in some ways. Not that what he said and what the direction he was going, we disagreed with, but it wasn't. He shouldn't have said PBS, which we knew that he represented PBS, and B, he could have done the same thing.
I don't think he could have. I think it could have been done differently. I don't think that we sent Stoney into a kid in a candy store of wanting to confront people. I mean, that was his deal. So if we had sent a different person, it would have been different. But I think Stoney,
I think
was predisposed to be confrontational.
And and it was more of a factor, a fear factor in the bureaucracy than it was actual acts committed, I think.
100%.
And that was a lesson for us in many ways, because it's sort of like you get censored, what happens to people is they self-censor because they're afraid of what will happen with the people who can decide things. And so that is a fear, both of free speech and of the kind of people and careers that we have had, which is to speak out and to say what we have to say. I found out about what they were doing from the woman who was the head of programming at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in a bar in Pittsburgh. It was a convention or something. And she told me that they had decided that they better not, that they weren't going to fund the 90s again. And we had a conversation about it. And she was in a place of saying she didn't necessarily agree, which is, of course, what happens in bureaucracies. But she was afraid of what the consequences would be. So that's how it ended.
Yeah, see that a lot in like liberal media, where it's like it's still leaning more towards like conservative. But yeah, I really liked it from what I read on like I think Chicago Reader, like the what he said. So yeah, I don't think it should have been censored either.
Tilt your camera down a little.
Okay. So my next question is, I wanted to like, so why was this like the final nail in the coffin, I guess? Because like I was doing research and there was like a previous episode on like weed and legalization, and you would think that's more like inflammatory than this.
So the weed episode was produced when we were still independent from PBS, and we were sending it to stations and they would pick it up. And so we weren't in the PBS, official schedule. So they really didn't have control over, I mean, individual stations could have kicked us off, but PBS nationally didn't have any control over what we were doing at that point. And they weren't funding us. And so it was a different deal. And as I recall, we didn't get in a lot of trouble for the weed show. I mean, from the stations didn't seem to, there wasn't much of a, at that point we were probably on, 150 stations, something like that. That was in the second season. So, all I remember from that show is us getting really outstanding feedback and not not necessarily from the stations, but from viewers. So.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess, like, my next question is, how do you think shows like the 90s and Image Union, like, connect to now? Specifically, like, for filmmakers and, like, myself, too. This kind of publicity would be really great for, like, us still, but we don't have that resource. Like, we more have YouTube nowadays. So how else can we create or, like, have a platform, do you think, like, in the future?
Wow, good question. I think because of the way things have gotten so consolidated in media, and that there's it's a different environment, it's a different world, and in terms of dramatic or narrative programming, that's a different story than nonfiction. And the only thing that's changed the way that's done, I think, in recently, is Vice. And Vice was funded, has been funded a lot, and certainly after a while, by HBO, which really doesn't try to interfere very much with the content and the independent producers who do it. And so, but there still costs a lot of money, and they still get a lot of money to do it. So I don't know the answer for how's it going to happen. I'm not sure. It's discouraging. You say, well, there's a million possibilities online, right? But how do you build an audience? We had hundreds of thousands of people watching the 90s. And to get hundreds of thousands of people, it's one thing to get hundreds of thousands of hits for short little stuff, but it's not the same as having an environment where people are watching programs per se. You disagree with that, Joel?
I don't disagree with that. And Vice is really its own thing, right? They don't do independently produced pieces necessarily, right?
They shoot them. They do them, sure.
I know they do them. They do them, but they are Vice, right? They are bringing stuff from other people to then broadcast. Or are they? I don't know. I definitely agree that Vice is the closest to the sensibility of the 90s that is on or has been on TV since. Very kind of, you know, bottom up look at things rather than a top down look at things. But I mean, your question is right. I mean, there's so much out there right now that could be curated and put out in the same way that the 90s was. And the fact there isn't a home for that, I think, speaks to Tom's point about consolidation and they are looking to build a, you know, it's trite to say, but it's all about the money that they're going to be able to make, on what they're putting out there. So if it's weird and it's new and it's different, it's hard to convince them that there's an audience for that and that there are people that they would like it, and they do the safer thing and create things that are going to be safe. And so it's kind of a, you know, a self-fulfilling deal on their end. So, so that's my.
Yeah. And the funding mechanism isn't anything like what it was, nor is
right.
Distribution system anything like it was in those days. So there's a time and a place for a lot of things. But how to skin that particular cat right now, I'm hoping we can figure that out even yet.
So I guess like my next question is kind of connected, is like, can you speak more about like the show's impact and reception? So like in terms of impact, did you keep in touch with like the video makers that were submitting, and did they reach out to you after to talk about the impact? And also like in terms of reception, what was like the response from regular people around you? And like, did it change at any point from like the beginning of the show towards the end? Like, did it go down over time?
Yes, to all of that. I mean, I think that we had an impact directly on people whom we had no idea, because it was television and it was going out, you know, broadcast to lots of people. So we changed some minds, and I remember particular incidences of letters and talk with people who we would presume would be watching, whether they were, you know, who regular working people or who were so enthusiastic because they knew from being intelligent and from having watched TV a lot, that this was something that they weren't getting anywhere else, and certainly in mainstream television. So that feedback was terrific, almost without exception. The press feedback was fantastic. I don't know if you've seen all the compiled press. Have you seen any of that?
I think I'm going in the office today to see it.
Okay, well, I have a bunch of that, which I can give you. But that reception, you know, that was terrific. In terms of the video makers, there's absolutely universal feedback from them that this was the best thing they had ever been part of. And the reasons are, one, they had the freedom to do what they wanted to do by and large, fitting into a relatively wide berth that we set up. Two, they got paid, and they didn't make a fortune, but they got paid. And three, they got feedback from everywhere for the pieces that they did. And so it enhanced both their work and their reputation, and it was a symbiotic kind of relationship with them. And I mean, I still hear from them. I'm sure you do too, John.
Yeah. And you know,
go ahead.
I was just going to say that really at the end, one of the things that, there was an issue was that we were getting so much stuff that an hour long wasn't enough. And it was hard to create something in with all that, you know, to be fair and to really represent what was coming and what was happening. It seemed like an hour didn't quite hold everything that we needed. And we, for, you know, we were a small operation considering what we were doing, there were very few people involved in the creation of each hour. And it was easier for us toward the end to put stuff in that, from people who we knew and who we could rely on to create things. And the stuff that was just coming over the transom didn't get enough attention because it was just too hard to deal with it all, frankly. It was too hard to like make it all a part of it. And some things obviously we did, but it just got really hard at the end with the amount of material that was coming in and only 1 hour of television to cram it into. Without, you know, cutting everything down, which we did for most things anyway, but it just wasn't the same. It was just hard to do. And yeah,
one of the foundations really of the 90s, as it was for me, for imaging, was to create an opportunity for people whose work wasn't seen on TV generally, or maybe at all up to that point. And so that was a mission, and that was an accomplishment. And it got a little, as Joel says, it became a little more difficult to accomplish that goal as time went on, because there wasn't enough room. Now, time and room to deal with it, and people in our group to deal with it. So for today, this is answering your last question. I think there's room for an online platform that has a whole lot more possibilities for showing stuff, and for choice, and for curation than anything that exists now. And that's what, underfunded, that's what we're working on at the moment. And I'm sure it's right. It may not be possible or practical, but I'm positive it's right that there is nothing that has the same kind of sensibility that the 90s had, or that Image Union had, that's even regularly seen and curated by people who have that sensibility, that you can get regularly online or anywhere. I'm not sure how to do it. We're working on how to do it, but somebody will do it, because it's important to do. If it isn't us, it'll be somebody after us.
Yeah, hopefully before like everything disappears and stuff.
Hopefully what?
Before like the things disappear, because you guys do the video preservation stuff too.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, that's a piece of it for sure. And the preservation video has to have outlets as well, because what we do at MediaBrand is just also really the tip of the iceberg in terms of distribution, in terms of being able to digitize and preserve. We're better at that than we are at putting it out.
So my last question, I guess, isn't really connected, but it's just more like a big overview, like a topical thing. So we're still dealing with like a lot of the same problems that you were censored for. And in general, like there was pretty radical content on the 90s. Is that coverage still different from what you see now, like on the news, and like in terms of like, I guess, like also like YouTube opening up a platform, I guess, for a lot of people to just put out their videos and like thoughts and commentary?
I don't think there's anything like it before or since. Full stop. YouTube has stuff on YouTube that is like it, but it isn't in a place that is, that it's contextualized, that it's of a piece. And a lot of people who put stuff on YouTube are trying to monetize what they're trying to put up on YouTube, right? They're trying to get as many people so they can monetize their opinions or their, you know, videos or whatever, which, you know, that's fine. But it's not the same as what we were doing. Not that we didn't want to make money, but that wasn't the point. The point was to try and create a place for as many voices and as much video as possible. And that does not, YouTube has that on the macro level, but it isn't something that somebody can go to and say, okay, I'm going to get this particular thing. I mean, when the first season of the 90s, Tom and I used to walk out of the edit room at 3 a.m. because we would edit it all in one day, and we'd go, oh, well, that was different. Like, none of them were ever the same, right? There wasn't anything. It wasn't like a Seinfeld thing where it was the characters were all the same and they would all go from A to B by the end of the show. Every show was 100% unique. So, and there just isn't anything like that. They're just everything at television by nature. They feel they have to package it in a way that is easy for the viewer to understand before they even get there. Right.
Also for the creators.
Right. That's what I mean. Yeah. So that's what I mean. Like saying there's nothing that has been like it before or since. It was a different mindset on how to create stuff and how to create the show.
In terms of YouTube, obviously that's bigger than anything's ever been. And there's more material and there's more voices probably than anywhere else. The downside of it is that it's not curated really. You can put in algorithms and you can get certain things back, but it's not the same as curating the content and the style in a way that gives a particular impression and political cultural result that came from the 90s intentionally. And the idea of every show being different is a fantastic thing when you think about it. I've produced a lot of TV shows, and Joel has too, but what happens with most of them is that there's a formula, in a sense, that starts with this, it goes to there, and ends this way. And most of commercial TV is like geared to the commercial holes. And there's a definite arc of the program. What we did, and part of what made it totally unique and non-mainstream, is that we took the material as for what it was. We took it for its value as we perceived it, and we put it together with other material that made sense to us as programmers. But in fact, that I call that at the time what Joel is a specialist in, or was at that time, which is associative editing. It's not exactly logical or intentionally what's the right word, boxed in. It's doing things from the association. It's on many levels. It's both the content, sure, it's the style, it's the flow of the material within that hour. So that has, and there's up and down of rhythm and of lightness and heaviness, and that's sort of an art. That's something that is difficult to do, and we developed it and evolved it, and I think that's part of why it was successful, at least to the viewers and to the press and to the producers and to the video people, makers.
I have like one final question, I guess. So like, you talk about letting the material speak for itself. So like when you were creating them, like each episode, I noticed there was like a theme. Did you like ask for submissions based off of the theme, or did you create it out based off of the videos that you put together?
Yeah, we we eventually, the first season we didn't. First season we kind of created what we had and, you know, picked from old stuff and new stuff that was coming in.
Not necessarily.
Well, no, I mean, we did not put out a call to say, we're doing an episode on taking chances. What do you got? Which is what we did later on.
Well, the other piece of it, if I can interrupt, is that...
You can.
We had our own video correspondents, five, six, seven, eight, nine of them as a group. And those are people whom we were in close touch with. And so when we were doing a particular show, we could go to them and say, hey, here's some of what we have. Try to do something that fits with that without telling them, go do something on taxis, you know. So we had that bumper. We had that ability to go to video correspondents who were people we trusted and knew and whose video would fit in with some of the material that we already had. And that evolved as we got kind of more focused on topics over the 52 hours we did. And less so, as Joel says at the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there were a few times, like for the taxi thing that Tom was saying, we said, oh, it'd be great to just sit in the back of a cab and talk to taxi drivers, right? And so we sent out to the five or six people at that point who we knew, just go talk to taxi drivers and because they're always willing to talk, and let's just get some good material. We got unbelievable stuff and built a show kind of around that. It wasn't the whole show, but it was other stuff about transportation and about people getting around. So that's kind of how we built them at the beginning, earlier. And then I think by season three, we were saying, we're going to do a show about money. Whatever you want to do about money, go figure something out, and they would go do it. Or we're going to do a show about the environment, you know, that kind of thing. So, and that was really a more of a producing mechanism for us to be able to keep a little bit of a handle on this kind of stuff we were getting rather than just random stuff, which we would all also get the random stuff. But that goes back to the point I was saying before, is that we started doing these subject matter ones, and then all this other stuff would come in, didn't fit into the subject matter stuff. And then what do you do with that? And, you know, so it was, it drove me to drink.
I won't go there. The thing about it is, back to the question of what feedback or response, at least in Chicago, where it ran, I guess, from the beginning, even though it wasn't a producing station for us, didn't start out being that. I know for sure that the ratings, that the viewership from the beginning was higher and larger than many of the PBS star programs, Nova and Masterpiece Theater and so on. So it spoke to a lot of people. And I suspect, from what we know, is it spoke to outside people who were outside the mainstream of public television viewers. It was, like everything else, it's difficult to be able to monetize that. But it's clear that we were doing something right in that way.